Hi everyone, Jack here. Our good friend Ted Janet was recently in London and had the chance to sit down and talk with Tony Stark, a filmmaker who has made documentaries for the BBC, Channel 4 and ITV in the UK, and a number of public broadcast channels in the US. Many of his documentaries are about religion, which is why Ted thought their discussion would probably be of interest to the listeners of The Pseudoscientists. So enjoy.
So we are here in London with documentary filmmaker Tony Stark. How are we doing?
Very well, thanks.
First question, just to get this out of the way, because I'm sure our audience are wondering, did Iron Man ruin your life?
Iron Man is the imposter, I have to say.
Right.
And I have a copyright on my name, and I think probably a big legal action might be in the offing.
That sounds good. It's nice to be named after a famous comic book superhero.
Well, actually, I'm always reminded of it. Wherever I go, yeah. Every shop, people are telling me.
Now, we're going to talk a little bit about Middle East politics and some child abuse scandals that you've been involved in as a producer of documentaries. But first of all, let's just talk generally. Your experience in documentary, what's in a nutshell, your life story?
In a nutshell. I was a newspaper journalist for a while. I trained as a journalist on mm-hmm. weekly newspapers, but I always wanted to work in television, so I got a job at the BBC many, many years ago, and worked my way through various programmes on the BBC, current affairs programmes they were, and then left the BBC 20-something years ago to be an independent filmmaker. I've always wanted to make films that have a significance in the world, however small, where you feel that by bringing the subject into the public domain, you're increasing public good to a small extent. So my approach is not to be polemical, it's to search for an essence of the truth in a subject.
That sounds fantastic. So tell us a little bit about some of the themes you like to explore in your various documentaries.
Well, that's really quite broad, because I've made films all over the world and on many different subjects. I have done quite a lot in the Middle East, on and off. I'm quite attracted to the apparently insoluble conflict between the Arabs and the Israelis. I find that a rather interesting subject to make films about. But the Middle East is the kind of driving engine behind a lot of terrorism. And I think if one could take the sting out of the problem, that is the Arab-Israeli conflict, maybe quite a lot of those problems might disappear.
What part do you think, and this is of particular interest to our audience, but what part do you think religion plays in the overall conflict between Arabs and Israelis?
A big part, albeit it's a territorial conflict, of course. Both Arabs and Jews feel that a certain bit of land, Palestine, is theirs, and they base that claim often, not always, but often on religious principles. So, Islamic people will say this is Islamic land. It's been our land for centuries, and the Jews who've came here quite late in the day and have taken it over, quite unjustifiably. And, of course, Jewish people who have very strong held views about their own history will say, hang on a minute, this is Judea and Samaria, the West Bank and Gaza, Judea and Samaria, and they were given to us by God. It says so in the Bible. This is our land, not your land, and it's been our land longer than you've been here. So it's a bit of an impenetrable, a bit of a difficult problem to solve when a territorial dispute has such strong religious passions behind it. That's why it's interesting.
As someone who's worked up from, as you said, current affairs news programs all the way to independent documentary, and now you're a producer, you don't physically make them. That's great.
Executive producer.
So what do you think, for example, something like the Arab-Israeli conflict? A lot of people participate in the argument, Jews all over the world, and I'm sure Muslims all over the world. Do you think that the general media that most people consume accurately conveys the message or the truth of the issue?
I think people pick the newspapers that reflect their own opinions often. Certainly people who live in Israel, Jewish people outside Israel, and Arabs will pick the news perspective that they want, and they're not necessarily getting the truth, the whole truth about the subject. They're confirming their own prejudices. Not everybody. I don't think that's fair to say about everybody, but I think a lot of people do.
What advice would you give? And this is, you know, maybe a bit of a difficult question, but from a skeptical community that, that this podcast belongs to, we're very interested in how we interpret facts and information. So I guess if you were telling someone how to read the news, what would you say?
Not sure what you mean by that.
Well, how to distinguish facts from conjecture, hyperbole, these kinds of things.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. The trouble with the internet these days is that, that there are millions of opinions. Mm-hmm. And there isn't enough, is it training or understanding, I think, that the source of your information is very important. I think people pick up...
Well, if I Google Barack Obama as a space alien, I will find quote-unquote evidence.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So you really need to question the source of your information. And that's one thing you need to do very, very carefully. And you also need to be prepared to go outside of your certainty zone and read what the other side's saying. And then you need to weigh up the evidence, which is what you do as a filmmaker, of course. You can't just take one... Well, you can. Many people do. But certainly the way I make films is not to just take one perspective, but it's to pursue a debate, if you like, because often conflict is a debate between two disagreeing peoples. And you have to have an ability to see both sides of the problem to try and give an essence of what that problem is. So you've got to go outside your comfort zone. That's what I would say.
That's really interesting. I mean, it is a pet hate of mine. I'm sure you've got them here in the UK, but like in Australia, we have these daily current affairs programs that are basically just tabloid sensational. You know, this causes cancer this week. This is, you know, this person's taking your money, these kinds of things. And so many people watch them. Does that keep you up at night like it does me?
Well, maybe it's fortunate that I don't see Australian television and read Australian newspapers.
You must have a lot of current affairs news information that's just scandalous and just...
Yes, of course. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Do you think that... I guess you must feel documentaries. I certainly think that documentaries, like the kind that you're espousing, can help remedy those kinds of problems in terms of our media content.
Well, if enough people see them, but these days with multi-channel television, audiences are fragmenting and declining. Unless people are watching what you might call quality or in-depth journalism. So when I first went into television, there was BBC One, BBC Two, and ITV. That was it. Mm-hmm. And so if there was a good documentary on, you know, say on the BBC. But certainly a third of the population would be talking about it the next day. Yeah. It's not like that anymore. So the amount of impact that you can have is relatively small these days.
On the other hand, I'm sure that plenty of people have discovered documentaries like yours and others online.
Maybe, some, yes.
That was my experience and certainly some of my peers. Like we would find these documentaries often from the UK or from abroad and we would watch them and show them to our friends at school, and that's how I got into skepticism, actually, and how a lot of people got into it. So that's really interesting.
Why skepticism?
Well, skepticism being the movement linked to new atheism, but distinct in that it's not just about... For example, atheism can be about critiquing religion, but skepticism has to do with critical thinking. So learning about things like logical fallacies and cognitive errors and learning how to read the news and knowing... You know, this is why I find this really interesting, knowing that the headline that says this causes cancer is probably built on a minuscule bit of distorted science research, which is part of a larger body. You've been involved in a plethora of productions, which we obviously can't cover the spate of today. The first one you were telling me is really interesting. Could you tell me a little bit about One Law for All, which sounds like a really interesting microcosm of Israel-Palestine conflict?
Well, yes, it was based around a Jewish soldier in Israel called Nathan Zada, who, I'm trying to remember how long ago it was, about 2005 or 6, got on a bus, drove into an Arab town in Israel called Shafa Amma, and shot everybody on the bus. And the police were called, and by the time the police got there, the bus was surrounded by hundreds of angry Arabs, who then broke the glass, burst in, and even though the police were there, killed him, beat him to death, basically. And then a couple of years, 2 or 3 years later, the authorities decided to prosecute, I think it was 12 Arab men for lynching him, basically. And the Arab community were extremely angry about it. Now, in most cultures here, particularly, if people take the law into their own hands, there would be outrage. And you'd say, of course, you can't just you can't, however much you might dislike someone, you can't just go and kill them. Whatever they've done, you have to let the law take its course. In Israel, it's not like that. Certainly not from the Arab perspective, because the Arabs feel that however well written and well meaning the law is in Israel, and it is well written, you know, it's applied in a discriminatory fashion. So that means that Arabs feel very much like second class citizens, in which the police don't apply the law and the judicial authorities don't apply the law fairly. So they felt, here is a Jewish soldier who's come in and slaughtered our people, and now you're telling us that you're going to prosecute 12 of our members for doing what is just only understandable and natural in the context. Now, there are arguments on both sides of that, of course. Some people will say, quite right, you're vigilantes, you're not, you know, you have to be brought to book, we can't have vigilantism. And they will say, but how many times have we seen Jewish people who kill Arabs who just get away with murder? And if you look at the statistics, as many of the human rights do, the Arab human rights and some of the Jewish human rights group, they're right. There are many incidents of killings where Jewish people get away with it. So that's why the Arabs are angry.
Typically military?
Not necessarily, no. Civilian, military. It's not necessarily military, no. It is that it is much easier to get the authorities interested in chasing and prosecuting an Arab than it is a Jew, basically. That's the problem. Yeah. Even though the law says you treat everybody equally.
Yeah. Now, of even more greater interest to this podcast is your last documentary, which unfortunately we won't see in Australia.
Nope. Unfortunately, you won't. That's right.
It's called Britain's
Hidden Child Abuse. Hidden Child Abuse. That's right.
Why can't we in Australia see this film?
Well, I'd like to be able to, you know, offer it to other broadcasters, but when you make a film like this, it's a very contentious film. You have to get insurance cover in case you get sued. It's quite a common procedure, and this was broadcast on Channel 4 here, and they offer cover under their insurer for the broadcast in the UK. Mm-hmm. So, in other words, if you're taken to court, the insurance company pays for all the costs, the legal costs. Mm-hmm. And you need that, because otherwise you can be bankrupted and go into, you know, by such a case. But they only pay for the UK broadcast. If you want it to be screened anywhere else, you have to negotiate a contract, an independent production company like my own, with an insurer to give you cover. Nobody will give you cover for a film like this because the risks of being sued are seen as being too high. So that's why you're not going to be able to see it abroad. I'm sad about that.
I could start off by introducing you, but I think when you tell it, it's much more fascinating. Please share it.
Well, it's very current because certainly in Britain, where we've got a real spate of sex scandals, you've probably heard about the Jimmy Savile sex scandal in Australia. Have you heard about Jimmy Savile? A very well-known BBC presenter for years and years and years, who ended up, he's died, and then it turned out that he'd abused hundreds, I think, of underage children. Nobody, even though people suspected it, nobody did anything about it. Mm-hmm. But anyways, but this isn't about that. This is because it's just current because of that. But this is about a religious community, the strictly Orthodox Jewish community in the UK, who live in parts of London, Stamford Hill in London, and up north, Manchester, Salford, and how some of their rabbis deal with allegations of child sexual abuse within their community. In other words, if somebody, a victim of somebody who says, I was abused by another strictly Orthodox Jewish person, goes to one of these rabbis and says, what should I do about it, Rabbi? Should I go to the police? The rabbi says, no, don't go to the police, on no account. Now, when we heard about that, I thought that's not right. That's morally incorrect. These people have no redress, real redress. Mm-hmm. They are sometimes of it. It's not that the rabbis are themselves abusing. It's not. They try and deal with it in an ineffectual way. They maybe get the victim to offer them money in compensation. But that's not enough when you've been sexually abused. You need a proper judicial process which can come to the truth of an allegation of abuse and sentence an abuser to a term of jail and maybe remove them from contact from other children. So we thought that would be worth investigating. And of course, it's very difficult to get the evidence. It's no good saying it. You actually have to show people what's happening. And that meant undercover filming of rabbis, which is a very difficult and sensitive issue. It also meant finding somebody from the community who could act as, be a vulnerable victim and go to them wired up with a camera. And you don't do that lightly. It takes weeks and weeks, months, in fact, of very careful consideration, lots of form filling, lots of ethical issues to think about before you do it. But that's what the film was trying to show people, that rabbis in the strictly Orthodox Jewish community are behaving immorally and actually skating very close to being illegal in Britain.
So this undercover proxy that you had, what happened to him?
He was, I can't prove it, but he has allegations of sexual abuse by a member of his family.
No, but I mean...
What do you mean, what happened?
Oh, wow, he was being honest in those confrontations.
In one of them, yes. In another one, he couldn't be for complicated reasons.
Wow. But my question was actually in relation to what's happened after the release of the documentary.
Not a lot. The strictly Orthodox Jewish community, certainly one of the rabbis we filmed undercover, basically gave us a statement saying that it's true that in our community people are very reluctant to go to the police. We're doing all we can to encourage them to do our best for our people. But of course that ignores the fact that they're reluctant to go to the police because of tradition that's boosted by rabbis who are telling them not to go to the police.
But this abuse victim himself, has he been excised from his community, or was that part?
He'd already left his community. Right, it's a very the strictly Orthodox Jewish community is a very, very closed community, and he was on the outskirts. He was a member. He has rejected being a strictly Orthodox Jewish person. He lives on the fringes now of that community, but he has entrees and access because he understands the customs. He understands, the Yiddish language, and so he could do the job for us.
That's fascinating. You hear these stories in so many religious institutions that are closed off like that.
You know, the problem for me as a filmmaker is that, as far as I can see, attitudes haven't changed at all. And the problem with the attitude is that, in the strictly Orthodox Jewish community, is that there is a concept called mezira, which means forbidden. It means that, and it comes from Jewish history, when Jewish people were persecuted and wandering around the world, persecuted by other cultures. It became the custom that you don't talk to secular authorities about anything to do with a problem in your own community. And that's why the Jewish community, the strictly Orthodox Jewish community in the UK, won't and doesn't want to have its dirty linen aired in a secular context, you see. And in fact, it's much worse than I've portrayed, because we had one story in the film of a young boy, 5 or 6 years old, who was abused by, whose father claims he was abused by somebody in a synagogue. And the father decided in the end to go to the police and make a complaint, which is quite unusual. It's very unusual in that community. And he was pilloried by his community. And in the end, he was so pilloried, he had to leave the country and go to Israel. The problem is that you're regarded as a traitor, and you're still regarded as a traitor if you talk to secular authorities about a problem between two Jews, strictly Orthodox Jews. And that is a deep cultural problem that one film is not going to break. It might make some inroads. The chief rabbi, who was the head of the strictly Orthodox community in Stamford, who was the one we filmed undercover, his group, the Union of Orthodox Hebrew Congregations, released a statement saying, we've now got a committee, there's a committee working, we've got a hotline, anybody who feels they've been sexually abused can ring the hotline, and a committee of the great and good has been set up to deal with it. It's no different from before. It means that before you go to the police, a committee of the great and good in that community decide whether to recommend that you should go to the police. They take the decision, not you. They're not saying to them, go to the police, they're the best people to deal with it. So there's been a little bit of change. I'm pleased about that, but not a lot.
Well, I guess awareness has been raised, which probably helps.
awareness has been raised, yes, and maybe if more members of that community decide to have the courage to go to the police, irrespective of what everybody says, that would be good. And slowly the barriers will be broken down if that happens. One person did actually, and we wanted to include their story in the film because they were the very first for, I think, a decade to be prosecuted in this, to have her alleged abuser prosecuted in this country. But when the film was going out, her case ended in a retrial. And we couldn't use it because it was sub judice. So we never used it. And in the end, it did come to trial and her abuser was convicted and was, I think, sent to prison for 3 years. So she was very brave, and it was a real pity we couldn't include her. So she was a very brave woman to do it.
Well, it all sounds like a very noble endeavour, and I hope one day the insurance wrangling can be done to share it with the rest of the world. Lastly, I think that there will be many in our audience who aspire to be not just journalists, but good journalists with integrity and delivering truthful information as they possibly can. What is your advice to them?
I think always be critical of whoever you're talking to. Always have a critical mind when you're talking to them, and always be prepared to consider that individual might be wrong and to look at alternative explanations or alternative opinions. And then when you've done sufficient research on both sides of a dispute or a problem, then you can reach a synthesis that shows what you believe to be the essence of the truth of that problem. And it might be grey rather than black and white. That's the point. It might not be as, when you enter a piece of research, you might see things much more black and white than when you come out the other end.
That's fantastic. I think that's a good place to leave. Thanks very much.
Pleasure.